Hi, this is Dave, and welcome. Who's here?
It's Terry Finney. I'm here.
Welcome, Terry. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. How's everything going for you? Any progress reports?
I have a progress report. It's just more kind of a client progress report. A woman I've been working with for a while who is pretty overwhelmed most of the time and has ADD, and she's now on medication. But I used the needs and ideals with her a couple weeks ago and has had huge, huge impact on her ability to focus her time and energy.
Well, good. How much have you worked with her to stay focused and work to sustain a state of mind and really work on the state changes and the sustaining states with her? Because that probably is the biggest key for somebody with attention deficit or attention challenges.
You know what? That is something that we've probably done, but not in a really focused way. We spent time on that. I just saw her. We just spent time on that today about carving out different sets of time for different purposes. Uh-huh. So maybe without using those words, we did that today. But I can certainly pull out that information and use that with her more.
Yeah, that seems so important for someone who is interruptible at the drop of a hat, who really needs to structure a time to have no interruptions, to be able to match state with exactly what she wants to accomplish and just create a structure that's going to support the kinds of endeavors that she has and to really be aware of that. That probably is the biggest management issue that she'll have is to really work with regulating her states and matching what she does to the state and protecting it, preserving it over time.
Interesting. Well, I think just getting her to kind of get a big picture, like the needs and ideals, is just so helpful for her. We can obviously add that, do that next week. That'll
Be great. I think I mentioned a case where I gave an example of someone with an ADD, a guy who had a CPA firm and wanted to, you know, go bigger with it, go national, and I had him do a weekly schedule to really map it out for the week, and then for each day to have hour by hour what he was doing, and to have that on his computer to the left of his screen. He had a big an iMac, and then on the right, the next best action, the task of that hour, so that he could always know where he was. So he had a master plan for the week, so he knew what to do and what kind of support to get, you know, when to, you know, not have interruptions and unplug his telephone or have his secretary redirect people, when to meet with people and do that back-to-back, when to do chores and run errands, to cluster all that, and how to protect the time, but also just the map of knowing where he was at any particular time so he could immediately know and focus and sustain that state. And he became amazingly productive when he did that because he needs a map, and he has a different kind of software system that needs a different kind of map than other people do. And I really hesitate and encourage people not to use deficit because it's just a different kind of software system. And there's a way to make that software system really amazingly effective because when somebody who has the attention challenges like that get into a focused state, they can sustain concentration with a power that's greater than you and I have. So once they have the structure, they can really do amazing work. So I, you know, recommend against calling it a deficit, but just looking at a particular organizational style, a particular software system, and how each of us has a unique software system. There are some principles for that kind of organization that can be helpful, and there are things that are useful for us. So I think it's just a matter of matching and collaborating about what works, because she'll probably have a good idea of what works. And the overwhelm is a state from the experience of, you know, too much of an overload, and it's kind of a retreat. So it's a way she takes care of herself to say, I'm overwhelmed, I'm checking out. There are better ways to take care of herself, even.
Right, and that's what we're working on.
Great.
Yeah.
Does what I'm saying make sense? And
yeah, no, it's really, yeah, no, it's really helpful. I was reading this morning, I was reading about, in the manual about state changes, and there's some verbiage that you use that I want to use more because it was really helpful. So, yeah.
Yeah, as you've heard me say a number of times, I think the understanding and management of state, regulating states of mind, is the most powerful thing that we can do with a client. Whatever
yeah,
that is
so, I think, you know, I've been in the field for 30 years, and that's the first time that I've really heard that articulated.
Hmm. What do you think now? I mean, I know you've had a great deal of experience. What do you think about how valid or the valence, the importance of it?
Oh, I think it's really important, and I think it might be something that we as therapists, psychologists, coaches do but don't really know that we're doing. And I think to just like have words for it and like a system and have it be more articulate is really helpful.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I
manage my own pretty well, but I've never really kind of had words for it. I just kind of do it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So useful. Thank you.
Yeah. I think the things that I want to really convey to each of you that I think will be so beneficial and will put each of you in a position as you really begin to think about integrating mind, body, spirit, but especially synthesizing from psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching, the things that are going to be most helpful have to do with regulating states of mind, with understanding the process of engagement of a client with a coach. And we're going to talk some more about that when we talk about the relationship module, about what gets recreated in the process, the attachment patterns of the client get recreated. And we usually don't look at it in that way. We don't look at the process as much as we do the content. So it's the process and particularly the attachment patterns that come alive in the relationship, I think, that have so much to do with helping someone become immeasurably more successful. So we're going to talk about that too. And that's something that I think that our group of coaches really develop in a way that is part of your unique offering. So thanks for mentioning that, yeah.
Welcome.
Who else? Ready to check in for wins or progress notes? One at a time. I assume that not everybody has headed out for Thanksgiving yet. Terry Holmes is going to present her roadmap today and has submitted a fascinating career one. Is Terry here yet?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Give us a progress note. What's going on?
Thank you.
Besides your roadmap.
Not much, just, well, actually a lot, but but we're just a lot in my world of work.
There was an amazing amount of work that was condensed into your roadmap, so I'm really eager for you to present it and to get responses from the group on that, because it's really a hardworking, unique, very rich piece of work. What was your experience in putting it together?
It was interesting because, I had the issue of I'd had my computer crash. Actually, it didn't crash. I had a malware virus and blah, blah, blah. And so any of my everything prior, all of my emails and information prior to October 28th were gone.
Wow.
So, yeah, which I had some things saved that I needed. So, and my downloads were gone. So, anyway, that was a little frustrating. But it was interesting because I think there was some resistance around there because the solution actually, Dave, was quite simple. you know, and so I don't know. I think there was some resistance around doing it.
Mm. So what did you learn that you can pass on to our group that might be helpful for us in working with clients and working with ourselves first?
Well, one of the things
I learned. That you learned?
Well, one of the things that I learned is, you know, like Nike says, just do it. I have a, and to take imperfect action can, you know, I create a lot of anxiety and stress anticipating doing something I don't want to do because it may not be perfect or right or good enough or any of that stuff.
Yeah,
so I really, I got real clear about that. And sometimes it's just necessary to take imperfect action.
I think that's so important. That we proceed organically, that, you know, to have a goal of perfection is to not have a goal because nobody ever gets there. It's you know, it is so important to do it as you're saying and to proceed and self-correct and move ahead. Instead of ready, aim, it's ready, fire, aim, you know, and then self-correct and move ahead. That's Stephen Covey's concept of moving ahead organically. And self-correcting as we move ahead.
Yep.
Great. Yeah. Okay. Super. Who else? Anybody else want to check in?
Hi, Dave. This is Jen Powers. I'm here, but I really don't
Welcome.
Have too much to check in on, if that's okay.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. That's great. Thanks.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Who is this?
Lalia.
Welcome, Lalia. How are you? What's going on?
I'm here. I just continue to just so resonate with this whole thing that you brought up. And again, it's not something you hear often about, that the most important thing you can do is to just help change the state of the client. I just want to hold on to that every time I talk to a client because I think that's so, for me, that's just very meaningful. So I want to just thank you for that in honor of Thanksgiving.
Okay, that's great. I will be having a white paper for our group. I'm not sure it will be ready by our February quarterly meeting, but inspired by some of the comments and some of the questions. One of the things I'm working on is one on attachment and attachment patterns. It's something that is well known and well researched in infants and children and adolescents, but not something that's really been applied to adults, and especially never been applied to coaching. And I think it's very applicable to coaching. So, it's, you know, the thing I'm working on while I'm here in New Orleans for this month is a book called Engaging the Ineffable. There are, you know, about 20 different ineffables that I'm engaging in this first run at it, that are things that we work with every day, but yet it's hard to really define them and really create working concepts and how can we best help our clients with this. You know, things like hope, nostalgia, some of the things that you haven't seen the previous white papers, but like the one that you received, desire. You know, a pretty common concept, but yet it can be complex, and we can really think about ways that we can help our clients engage with these issues. And one of the future ones is attachment. And I'm that's why I welcome feedback on those white papers because I'm those are initial drafts for pieces for the Engaging the Ineffable. So that's what I'm working on, and that's what I've been working on for most of this month are things like that, and attachment is one of them. So it's something that is in the foreground of my thought, and I'll be sending something around in the not-too-distant future to see what you guys think about it. And I really welcome input and feedback and that sort of thing, and especially to see if it's useful. First of all, if it makes sense, and then to see if it's useful. So that's a preview of a coming attraction, because I think there are some aspects that I'm seeing and really thinking about that are immensely applicable in coaching in ways that have not been done yet, and I think will contribute to your unique offerings. Now, before Terry presents her roadmap, anything else? Any challenges? Any things with your cases or in the reading that would be helpful for us to talk about? Okay. Terry, would you do your roadmap?
All righty. Well, mine is, I'm in a space of a transitional space right now. I've been a ballroom dance teacher for 35 years, and I've also spent a lot of time training other professionals in the industry and operating my own business. And I'd had a couple of knee replacements within the last year, and I'm doing extremely well, and I'm still able to teach, but that kind of created a, ooh, I may not be able to do this forever. And prior to that, I had been looking at the possibility of having a coaching practice in and of itself. I use a lot of my coaching and my coaching skills working with couples in relationship issues and utilizing the process of learning to dance for conflict resolution and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I do recognize myself as the author of my existing career story. I'm clear that it's up to me if I wish to create another career story. And I do have some fear and sadness around the transition from doing what I'm doing to just coaching. And I think it's a fear of the unknown. Can I do this? Will I be successful? You know, all of those kinds of unknowns. All of my coaching experience has occurred and flowed naturally through my experience of teaching dance. And it's kind of scary to think about coaching outside of that context. So that's kind of my recognizing the authorship part of my roadmap. The accountability, basically I know that the accountability is a prerequisite to change, and I can hold myself accountable when these old tapes about my personal worth and abilities begin to play. I can perform an inquiry as to their validity. My usual pattern of avoidance is to become very busy. I get really, really busy, and oftentimes my busy is uninvestigated busyness. And when I really truly investigate that, I do have plenty of time in my schedule that is open and available to pursue a coaching practice. And I do recognize, and I really don't know that this is something that just came up for me, is I have a memory as a small child of my big sister was just, she liked to do things for me. She took care of me. I was her little doll, and she liked to take care of me. And I remember my mother quite innocently. Actually, I can remember my sister was tying my shoes for me and my mother telling her to stop doing things for me because I would never learn to do anything for myself. And I've been proving that wrong for my whole life, trying to be perfect, and I can do it myself and I can take care of myself. And so I was also told, in this I wrote that I was also told to give up on my desire to perform and to get a good education and a good job. So that could be read as being told not to do those things. I was told to give up on my desire to be a performer, that's a rough life, you know, blah, 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 and just to get a good education and get a good job. And so in my typical defiant style, I was a very precocious teenager. I dropped out of high school, got a GED, went to work. I've owned and operated my own business now, my existing business, for 15 years. And before that, I was helped to, myself, my husband, and my family, we traveled and helped other people get dance studios going, got them up and running, and then we would move. So I've spent the last 35 years accumulating, I'm pretty highly certified in my existing occupation, and I also have a number of other management certifications and things. Most of my schooling, I pursued areas of interest and not degrees. So I kind of went the certification path, and between my coaching certifications, management certifications, dance certifications. But I always feel like, and I look at that and I say, I still always feel like I don't know enough. I need to buy another book or read another book or take another course or get another certification in order to be ready. And I'm always afraid of they the elusive they finding out that I don't know what I'm, I really don't know what I'm doing. So shall I just proceed, or?
Absolutely. That very insightful and introspective to put into this work piece.
So basically what needs to change, there are many things that I'm really very positive about and really like. I don't feel like I need to do a life overhaul or anything. I am curious as to where this comes from, you know, what to do with all of this never feeling like I'm enough or I've got no enough or good enough. But I am ready to accept and live into my power, the skill and knowledge that I have. Not only do I know enough, but I'm actually a very good coach. I've had a number of my clients are marriage therapists. I have a psychologist and a psychiatrist that I work with as a couple who come to me for their relationship stuff and very much feel that it's everything that's taught in relationship work in action. You have an opportunity to actually put to practice that which you're learning and working on in relationship, in the area of relationships. So I will keep my self-determination and put it to good use to further my desire for a coaching practice. And as my old tapes begin to run, I will inquire as to the validity of what they're telling me and utilize all of my experience and knowledge and training to make a valuable contribution to the clients that I serve. Perhaps that will not be outside of the arena of dance, but I would like to believe that if it becomes an inevitability that I can no longer teach or dance, that I would still be able to pursue my coaching. And to create the new career story, I'm a very skilled and knowledgeable coach, and I trust in my skills. I'm now making the contribution that is both rewarding and valuable to my clients and myself, and I'm now making the difference in the world that I've always wanted to make. I no longer need to wait and prove my worth. I know enough, and I am enough to step into my best life now. And then to program new experiences, I accept my personal story, and through that acceptance, now know that I'm enough and I have great value to offer through my coaching. I will continue to grow and increase my value to my clients, live my best life now instead of at some time in the future that never comes. I take action each day to move forward and live into that wonderful future that I'm creating. And one of the things that I have done is I've started putting together a blog. And I do have a website and everything for my dance business, but I'm in the process of also putting together a website for my coaching business.
Super. Now you said you're developing a blog?
Yes.
Excellent. I think that's probably the best marketing that anyone can do at this point. If I were starting out fresh, just beginning, the way I would start would be a blog before a website, before anything else, only after letterhead stationery, but then a blog would be right up there because I think that's the way you get your name and your information out there.
So and I agree. I have, it's interesting because I do, I've started businesses from scratch and I put together the processes and the systems and everything, but I've been very reluctant to, you know, I've had this thing that just holds me back from creating a coaching business as a separate entity from my dance business. And I really would like to do that. I think that there's a lot of fear around that, but I think
I want to stop you for a minute because if you were coaching someone, you would want to stop someone when they said, this thing that holds me back. You're speaking as if you are the subject of that story rather than the author of it. And what
you
just did was an excellent piece of work to recognize that you're the author of this entire story. You did an excellent piece of work to move from a fixed mindset where you assume you always have to be validated, where you have to prove your worth, to a growth mindset of revising the software to know and to believe that what you do is important, and that allows you to proceed in a very different way from a very different position and to have significantly more effect. So you've done a great deal of that work. That little piece right there needs to catch up, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for that catch.
And because I think all of the work you've done is to move to an active position where you're right writing your story, and it's not there until you create it. So if there's a thing that holds you back, it's you actively at this moment stopping yourself. And then, rather than obscuring or overcoming or invalidating or obliterating an obstacle, would simply be to not create it, to move that energy into what you want to do, which is exactly what you've done with the roadmap.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dave. That's great.
Yeah.
It's very helpful.
And just, you know, we don't talk much about marketing, but I think that in a couple of you have heard me say this before. I think the blog can be so beneficial when you have a blog that's branded, when you look at creating and crafting exactly what you want to do with the blog. It can be the best marketing piece that you have, because it's something that can go viral. It can be picked up by Google Alerts. This is what I know a couple of you have heard me mention before. When I started to blog, I sort of resisted doing it because I thought what the world needs is just one more unedited piece out there. But my publishing house, McGraw-Hill, really nudged me to do it, and I finally did it. And I got to a point of really enjoying it, because if you write to see what you have to say and what you want to learn rather than because you know something, you know, that's another component of a growth mindset. You write to see what you have to say. You write what you want to learn most about. So a blog is one way of doing that, and then you begin to see all kinds of things that are bloggable. And I had as many, it took me 4 months of doing a blog to get as many subscribers as it took 4.5 years of doing a newsletter. And I did all the right things and got a substantial following for the newsletter by having it on my homepage and having a couple of white papers that were downloads. But a blog can be really substantial. And I've had clients who have contacted me because of a blog. So I think it can be very important. And I think it's something to highlight while we're looking at this to do for your marketing. I know some of you, Jennifer particularly, has published and does a lot of workshops and newsletter and things. I know some of you really do this. Jennifer, do you have any tips or best practices that you want to pass on to our group from what you've learned?
In terms of
marketing? I know you do a great deal of things in the marketing arena and publishing and all that.
Yeah.
Anything that you just think about?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask, because just this morning I was listening to a guy I subscribe to. He has a 30-day kind of like how to get the word out about your book, or how to, I don't know, whatever it is you're writing. And he had a really interesting point that what we think the typical avenue is now is social media, and you know, you get your Facebook and you get your Twitter, and that's going to get the word out because it's so viral. But he had case study after case study proving that it was really the blogs and the e-zines that, like Dan Pink, for example, was one of his examples. And you know, Dan Pink has, like 50,000 followers, I think, and 200,000 subscribers on his e-zine, and he got so much more, like 15 to 1. He sold 15 more books to 1 than he did on Twitter. You know, he sold more from his e-zine list. And I think it just has to do with what I took away was the personability of it. And it kind of speaks to what you're saying. You know, there's just like more of your soul in something that you're writing to your list, and that you're not just tweeting from the bathroom, you know. And then the other piece is that they're really true fans. Like I think there's a bigger commitment when they sign up for your e-zine or subscribe to your blog than if they just click, you know what I mean, or follow on Facebook and Twitter. So that was a good takeaway for me today.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's really important, because with a blog or with an e-zine, you're really developing more of a relationship or a following in publishing. It's called a platform, and you have a chance to really create a conversation, and you get the ability to have people respond to you, to a blog or to an e-zine, and you're really developing a relationship in a very different way than you are with one of the social media sites. So not that you can't do all of it, but, you know, certainly this is where, as Jennifer's saying, you really develop the impact of a relationship and a following that can be substantial and significant. And that allows you even more so when you write, you're really speaking to a specific group or a specific entity of people. I always find it useful. Everything I write, I dictate. But I'm imagining an audience, whether that's one person or a group or a small group. I envision an audience, and that allows me to specifically speak to that group. So the more specific and circumscribed I have in my mind that group, the more meaningfully I can engage in a conversation with them. So I think those are just some things to think about. So any responses or other follow-up to Terry's roadmap? Congratulations, Terry, on that work. I think it was really important. Are there other things that any of you want to talk about or mention to Terry?
This is other Terry. You know, I will just tell you, I have all of those degrees, and I still have issues about I don't quite know enough. If I read, like, one more book or take one more class or yada, yada, yada. So there you go.
So I'm not alone.
Nope.
Well, yes. And that is a mindset that can shift slightly to looking at acquiring and integrating. I say something very similar when I look at new books, new things that are coming out, new research, and follow that through Google alerts and through, you know, books and that sort of thing is, wow, that may be something that I can integrate and use and pass on to my coaches or use myself or use in writing. So the acquisition of information and the integration is there. It will feel different and it will feel more fulfilling if you look at it in terms of enhancement rather than in terms of deficit. Think of the difference in feeling.
Yeah.
And the experience.
There is. It's very distinct.
Uh-huh. Yeah, my most enjoyable and creative time is in the late quiet of the day when I'm reading or when I'm dictating and writing. That's the most creative time for me to do that because it's new ideas. It may be stimulated by somebody else's writing. It may be totally in my own reverie, but that kind of thing is what we're talking about with just a slight shift to looking at putting together all the things that you know that you've already done and have done for 30 years and have developed businesses and a whole industry around this. It's just you're doing it now from a slightly different position. And you're going to be well paid for it. You're going to make a huge impact with people in their lives as you already are. Each of you are. So thanks very much for that. That was an outstanding piece of work and presentation. I want to move into our material, and again, keep the line open in case you want to interrupt or question or just talk about something for a moment. I'd like you to write down these three questions. What's your money story? Now, when you think about it, it's not your income, your expenses, your assets, your debt, but your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Secondly, what do you consider a healthy relationship with money? And third, ideally, what would you like your money story to be? So let's talk about this story. You're writing a story that you may not know exactly how to tell. It's very personal, with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, you think about several times a day. It's remarkably simple, yet intricately complex. It has an internal and an external dialogue. It has encrypted messages, even a secret language. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. You engage it every day of your life. Your parents talked about it before you arrived. People are going to deliberate it after you're gone. Maybe you'll get 10 years out of a car, maybe 40 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of your life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted by this story. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your moods, adjust self-esteem, influence others, maybe even soothe emotional pains. And this is the lifeline clue. The villain or the hero of this story is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you. You speak with it. Of course, it's your money story. Now, let's consider, in looking at these two questions, what's your money story and what would you ideally like your money story to be? What is a money story? Your money story is not your income, your bank account, your investment portfolio. It's really the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale that you tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. And it's a running dialogue that contains things like how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you think you're capable of. It's also about what you believe would happen if you had more or less. Think about the ways that we speak with money. We speak with money in a number of ways. In a straightforward way, money says whatever you tell it to. It conveys any language. The wonder of money is it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize or desire, for what we fear or lack. We use money to show how much we care, at times how little. We use it to measure success and buy happiness, or try to. We use it to bolster self-esteem, to regulate moods, to influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. Another way that we speak with money, as a self-statement, and money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements. And, of course, the story tells most about the teller. These are just some of the themes of that story. Proclamation for freedom, assurance of love, embodiment of power, affirmation of autonomy, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, to foster alliances or exclusions, as an instrument of control. For example, we see a new car and want it. What we're really doing is acting out our money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that says, this car is part of my identity. It will make people respect me. It will validate me. I won't have to worry anymore. The obvious example is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW 550 and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW 550 in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a self-statement, by the way. I'd never buy a red BMW. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. And we use money in self-talk, the messages we tell ourselves, the internal beliefs. And these are important because these are not always in the surface story. These can be shadow stories. People who have significant money are lucky. People with real money, serious money, are different from me. You have to work hard to really make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. I really think that money can buy happiness. And money means the same to everyone. Now, our money stories are a large part of our life stories. Some of the money issues are really about money, but many are about other matters, private or even secret, that hitchhike on money. We take money, the tool, way too seriously at times. We don't take our money stories seriously enough to recognize that we write them, live them, and can revise them. It's hard to get money just right. It may occupy too much of our lives or too little. Its importance may inhabit too large a place or too small. Now, let's talk about the inner dialogue here. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can talk about a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? You probably won't see dessert. An agent at a writer's conference discussed working, and this was an internationally known agent, really well-known agent, was discussing with us at a writer's conference, working with authors over the years, the agent-author relationship. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations and a whole number of things. Finally, somebody in the audience said, would you talk about how much money is involved in book deals so we can get an idea of what to expect? She looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself, and then another guy from another back row said, well, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of those sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion that was really useful to her audience, many of whom were interested in writing books for a living. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. That was written exactly one century ago. The therapist Sigmund Freud. A century later, most of us have learned to talk more easily about sex, yet remained seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own money stories. In fact, the sort of paradoxical thing was the first book I did about money had that quote on the front flap. It was in 1986, a book called The Last Taboo. It was about money in therapy and analysis. And at that time, it was only the second book in existence about money in therapy and analysis, fees, that sort of thing, even though it's something that therapists and analysts talk about and deal with several times a day. There was a panel that I was on, and they were asking for references. And I had already seen that there just weren't references. People weren't writing about this. The only other book, the only book at that time was one about 20 years earlier, written by a psychoanalyst about the symbolic meaning of money. Nothing was written, and people just weren't talking about it, and that panel really crystallized some issues. So while we may not speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We create internal and external conversations about money. We have dialogues in our minds before, for example, making a decision to exchange our money, which is really our time and energy, for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. How do I know this? Because there are two parts of the brain. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. The secret language is the one we speak to ourselves, the internal dialogue that's often silent, of what we tell ourselves about money. Let me give you some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. When school started, I saw my classmates enjoying sodas and candies at the snack stand after lunch, joined them. And it dawned on me about halfway through the first time, was that candy worth a half row of chopping cotton? Will I get enough from this soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? And I very quickly answered no to both questions. And that's something, if you think about it, we all think about offering to our kids the value lessons of looking at the choices of spending and the wisdom of spending. I did a clothes allowance with my kids so that I could be a collaborator instead of an authority figure of saying yes or no to every request, so that we could then collaborate about, you know, how to spend it, how to look ahead, how to, you know, apportion things with two alligators worth one horse and pony. But also, this that I'm speaking of right now looks at something we often don't consider, is the cost of money. And that's important, too. And I'll come back to that. Another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. The preamble of spending may be to rationalize or justify spending. Well, this seems like a lot of money to spend on a big screen HD TV, but if you amortize it over 9 years, it only costs 17 cents a day. And then my wife said, Dave, if you want the TV, just go ahead and get it. Now, another, and this is a framing bias. We regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed pretty frivolously. Gifted money, spent without debate pretty much. Salary money or professional fee money, serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement, only with definite need or emergency. And it's the same dollar. It doesn't even know who owns it. It just has different meaning depending on the frame we put it in. Another example, the spender. The high from shopping is more powerful than the low from the bankruptcy. That was a statement from a documentary for a woman who was about to file her fourth bankruptcy. Or the parent who says, well, I spend so much time at work, when I'm off, I'd like to buy my child something to make up for it. Now, one other consideration. Money speaks to us. Money sometimes speaks to us just below our conscious awareness. It can speak to us as confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, or drug. It can serve as a tangible container for hope, freedom, ambition, any of the things that I mentioned before. It can become a currency of caring, a symbol of success, a measure of power, a promissory note for happiness. Any number of things can be written onto this because it's like a Rorschach. We project our own meanings onto it. We make money mistakes because we use money to accomplish non-financial goals. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and actually make it bigger than it is. Because when you think about it, it's simply a medium of exchange, a unit of value. The more we give money meaning, the more we lose our focus on what it really means. And then we do strange things with money. Think about some of these things. Intelligent people spend more money than they have. They spend money they don't have, in other words. Sophisticated people can get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. I've had two clients, one of whom a well No, a nationally known person, who were Madoff victims. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise, balanced individuals spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. They can't enjoy their money either way. Dependable people can ignore financial matters until they get really serious. Highly principled individuals can step over boundaries and write their own rules about money. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that can imprison them until they're listened to. So why is our money so important? Well, it permeates everything we do. It ghostwrites every aspect of our lives. What we eat, drink, read, fear, plan, and buy all are affected by our money story. Our health, our jobs, our families, our dreams are all impacted by our money story. Day by day, thought by thought, and dollar by dollar, our money story becomes a part of our life story. And it's important for another reason. The money story we each live will be the one that we teach our children and our clients and our employees. It will be the one that is part of an attachment pattern, part of what's downloaded as an operating system in terms of meaning and significance and all the operating system components while we're talking about other things. So when we talk about money, our experiences and ideas regarding money, we're really talking about ourselves. A money story reveals our relationship to ourselves as well as to money. Now, let's look at the power of story applied to money here. There was a study in which volunteers had their brains scanned using fMRI scans, functional magnetic resonance imaging, in other words, the video of the brain, when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon, and they were told the prices of each of these 5 wines, the 5 Cabernets. The volunteers not only rated the wines according to the stated prices, in other words, they rated the most expensive wine the most enjoyable, best tasting, and sequentially on down, least expensive, the least favorite. And the volunteer showed a corresponding increase in activities of their brain. The most expensive, the one they enjoyed the most, had the greatest firing in the pleasure center of the brain, and then on down sequentially. Their brain scans matched exactly their reported findings. Now, the volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They actually experienced more pleasure. Their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. And very recently from MIT, I saw a study in which the most expensive placebo was more than 2 times more effective than the cheapest placebo. Now, so here's a money quiz in the workbook section of the curriculum. Look at your answer to number 3 if you've had a chance to do this. Remember, the first 2 questions are, what do you make now? What would it take to have no worries about money? Number 3 question, one word, first word that comes to mind, what money means to me. And think about what your answer was, or think about it right now. One word, what does money mean to me? This is how money can make any statement. Some of the most common answers, worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power, any number of possibilities. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. A desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and desires can be created by filling them. Marketers know this. And money is the legal tender of desires. As I mentioned, money becomes the ink block of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper, but when offered the chance to imbue that design with meaning, the interpretations will be as wishful and as varied as the fantasies of the respondents. So let's look a little bit more at these money equations. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth or their morals. One woman said, well, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I should have good money. Well, we know that money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps you money. are even related to their ethics. President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, we know better than that. You may work hard, but you may overspend. You may gamble. You may have five children, three of whom are college age. You may live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or you may have a shopping addiction. Now, here's a kind of a sidebar question, but I want to make a point with it. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic? Now, I know one or two of you have heard me do this before, so don't take any side bets if you text each other. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic of all jobs, profession, ethnicities? Cast the broadest net possible. Who has the best work ethic in America? What's your guess? Anyone? Take a chance. I've had guesses of, you know, immigrants in Texas, shrimp boat workers, farmers. Are you ready for
I'd say
answer?
Women with children.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer, yeah. Well, are you ready for the other answer then? Heroin addicts. They get up every morning, and this is how one person put it. He said, I have to get up every day at the crack of dawn. Actually, before the crack of dawn, I have to work every day, all day long, because if I don't, the next day, my self-esteem doesn't suffer. The next day, I die. So I emphasize that to really look instead of work ethic, which is just putting in hours at a desk. You know, you've heard, well, I was on a desk for 10 hours today. Instead of work ethic, think about performance ethic or success ethic, an objective other than just doing what you're supposed to do and sitting there, whether you're productive or not. So performance ethic or success ethic, think about that when you hear a client talking about how much work they do. Now, I want to review for just a moment. We talked about a money story. Let's look at a debt story, because this is a close component. I mentioned to you that my very first client as a coach was someone who had wanted to come to Houston and pay for like 2 weeks of working all day long every day, and I declined. And then she waited until I was certified as a coach and then hired me as a coach. What we found out, and it took about 5 months, I think, of working together on a weekly basis before she finally revealed what was the most shameful aspect of her entire life, is, and she worked, and this was someone who was well known in an arena that I can't say anything because it would be too revealing, that related to money. And this is somebody who knew exactly what to do and what not to do. And she revealed that she had over $500,000 in debt that no one, including her husband, knew about. And she was absolutely stressed because she was working and a lot of it was like credit card rates, really crazy rates, that she was working very hard just to service the debt at times each month, and sometimes she didn't do that. And this was a very well-qualified, very well-known professional. So if money were about math, we wouldn't need to be talking. If money were about math, no one would have at least personal debt, maybe other than a house, but I'm not talking about business debt or a mortgage. I'm talking about personal debt. But more than math, money is about emotions and psychology. It's about each individual money story. The average American family now has 6 credit cards on which they carry an unpaid balance of more than $9,000. For these families, if they pay off their balances by making the minimum payments, it would take them almost a century to pay off the credit card debt. The debt story has become a strange, addictive world of spending and debt. And this client I mentioned, she did not have psychological problems. This had just come to be a story in and of itself that she did no longer feel the author of. money's become more abstract, like using credit cards, so our debt soared. Now, in this, since you ask, is a 22-second history of money. Initially, two goats were traded for five bags of rice. Then, coins represented what their actual value was. The actual value was there in gold and silver. Then, paper bills. And then, paper that was a symbol of money. Then, checks. Then, plastic. Now, a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money's become more abstracted, our understanding of our relationship with money has faded. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands, our bank's hands, our broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, neurological wiring. So the important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't. Ones, the components that work don't need fixing. Ones that don't work may need to be revised to enhance your both your money story and your life. Now, I want to give you a quiz. I know a couple of you are familiar with this from our previous collaboration. So, again, don't take any side bets on texting. But this was a survey that was done of several thousand professionals by the Wharton School of Business. They did a survey of what is the most important thing that will have a professional, that will have someone sign on or decline professional services. And the same reason is there, most important reason that someone signs on for professional services or declines someone's professional services. What do you think it is? Their credentials, the professional's credentials, the reputation, experience, the amount of the fee, or the state of the economy? What's your guess?
The state of the economy.
Okay, that's a good guess. Others. Anybody else have a different answer?
I do, but only because I already know the answer.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, the answer, this is not quite fair. The answer is none of the above. It's how you state your fee clearly in your recommendation. The clear, confident stating of your fee in your recommendation. What the Wharton School of Business found, there's several thousand professionals. The credibility of professionals is hurt if they're fuzzy about fees because it damages the trust that a client has. And for most people, the issue isn't whether the fees are high or low, but that the professional is clear, direct, and confident about the recommendations and about the fees. So no matter how capable you are, clearly discuss your fees for the client to engage. Now, here's an application, a reason why. Because our minds seek closure and our brains tend to want to end any dissonance. So that's why we have that mirroring effect and the closure with the clarity and with the confident recommendation because we believe in somebody. This is a series of studies that I think are related, and see what you think, by Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard, showed volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was subliminal programming. There would be a word that would appear for 1/50th of a second so that somebody wasn't aware the words were shown. They couldn't pick them out or guess from a multiple choice, yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers would judge others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform less well on tests. And when these volunteers were asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, of course they didn't know, but they would always come up with some reason that made it make sense. For example, if they walked more slowly, they didn't believe that these effects were legitimate. Then they were showed the films that, yes, indeed, they walked more slowly, the before and after films in each. And they said, well, I don't know, it's probably a mistake, but if I did, it's because I was a little jet lagged, or I was a little bit tired, or I haven't been sleeping well. In other words, they falsely attributed cause and effect in order to bring some closure. And these findings, their responses, demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure for the brain to end any dissonance and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation, because it infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness to be able to explain. Now, let me give you an example here, an application. As an explorer, by all accounts, Columbus was barely an average sailor, but in one area he was a genius. People believed in him. He projected a sense of confidence that was completely out of proportion to his means. It was a quiet and calm self-assurance, like the people in the study from Wharton. In fact, it was the same confidence usually shown by the nobility themselves. The powerful in the old-style aristocracies felt no need to prove or assert or sell themselves. Being noble, they knew they deserved more and asked for it. They were entitled. Columbus got full funding from the Queen of England to sail not one but three ships on the basis of an idea. And it was really a kind of a goofy idea. It was an eyebrow raiser and an eyeball roller combined. To find a new world? Yeah, right. But Columbus taught others how to respond to him by believing in himself. So, the most important person to convince about your professional fee is yourself. When you value your services, others will too. And remember, it's up to you to set your own price. Ask for less, and that's exactly what you'll get. Ask for more, and you send a signal that you're worth it. Even those who may turn you down respect you for your confidence, and that respect will pay off in ways that you can't imagine or that we couldn't predict right now. Any thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to discuss further?
Dave, this is Jen. I have a question. I apologize for the background noise. I'm having to drive for my next appointment. So I heard that the need for closure and that sort of thing when presenting your fees, it begs the question, are you best present, is the deliverer of the fees or the service professional best present when giving fees? Does that make a difference as opposed to having the person in their own quiet see the fees for the first time and decide?
Jen, I'm not quite sure I understand your question. Would you ask it again about what are the two different, are you talking about two different settings about recommending a service and fees, or tell me again because I'm not quite clear.
Okay. So I used to, on the phone with my potential clients, I used to state the fee. I used to tell them, and then we'd have a dialogue about it. They would tell me, you know, oh, well, I'd get their reaction, you know?
Right.
And sometimes, most of the time, my fee was a surprise to them, so of course I could read that. And then I decided that I didn't want to have that conversation anymore because I couldn't close it. Like it wasn't within my reach to do that. So I don't have that conversation. I send them now with a packet. Like I send them a packet and they look at it and it's all the information in there, and then they have their own conversation with themselves or their spouse or whoever it is they need to refer with, and then they come back to me and they respond. And I'm pretty sure I'm practicing avoidance there, you know, by doing that. But I like it, and I just don't know if I'm missing something.
Well, okay, here's the question, because your question is this a question about your comfort, and are you avoiding something, and does that displace it to the client? But the real question is, does it work, and have you done a controlled study of doing it both ways to see which works the best? That's the only question here, because you can get comfortable stating your fees, but the question is, what works better? So have you done a controlled study, or do you have any ideas what the results are of each of these ways of doing it?
Yep. My that's an easy question, because what I'm most comfortable with is going to give me the best return,
yes,
right?
That's true. You're absolutely right.
So, yeah, it just feels icky to me to do it, so I'm better not doing it and better sending it. And I've gotten really good feedback from clients that they like it too, because the conversation about money is hard and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, yes, it's better this way. And I wonder if from what you're saying, if there's an element that's missing by me not being present in that conversation.
You know, I don't know. I think you're very right that you're going to get the best response
mm-hmm.
from people when you're comfortable and
mm-hmm.
your comfort and your confidence is going to be conveyed. And the medium of doing it in the way that you do it best
mm-hmm.
is the vehicle for your comfort and your confidence. That's going to work the best.
Right.
Now, I think we have to ask another question, and I don't know the answer to this. Are you pre-screening for people who may need to address it directly and are not, because you're getting people who are also comfortable with dealing with it by not making it part of the conversation or part of the relationship? So the question is, does it come into the relationship at a different point, even for people who do come to you and pay in that way? Because the fee is something, it's the only framework boundary that we have. That's the only rule we have, that people pay us. Everything else is a recommendation. So for people who have boundary issues and they have difficulty with money in their lives, that's going to show. And my theory goes, that's going to show in the attachment pattern with you. So how does that come up, or does it come up in the relationship with you, and then how you deal with it?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't want to monopolize time. I know the answer to that.
I think it's a fascinating question. You know, it's why, for example, I don't have fees on my website, but when I make a recommendation to someone, I recommend how we work together, the frequency, the standing time, and talk about what my fee is and the way it's structured and what it includes. So it's part of the relationship from the beginning so that there can be questions about it. And then I have a link that I send to someone, and I have three different sets of fees, depending on the kind of coaching I'm doing for individuals. And I send them that link specifically so they don't see comparative prices or know they're paying more or less and that sort of thing. So they get the link where they pay prior to the first session and do a monthly retainer, and then it automatically bills at the same time the subsequent months until they unsubscribe, until we're done. So I make it part of the discussion from the beginning so that there's the opportunity to bring it into focus. And for, you know, a bunch of people don't have money issues. Some people do. And the people who can't afford you, and this is to everyone, the people who can't afford you are probably the people who most need to work with you. So money issues are going to be there in the exchange that you have, because you're selling your professional time to the client, and that's all you're selling. Everything else is part of the exchange and part of what you do in terms of working with the client. But you are selling your time. So the things that have to do with money and their money story will probably emerge either in content or in the process. And in the process, it makes it hard. But that's also where the real work can come, because it comes alive like other things in the process, in the relationship. It comes alive in the story of the coach-client relationship. And we're going to talk more about that, as I mentioned, as we talk about the relationship module. Other thoughts are good. Great question, Jennifer. Thank you for asking that. Other things that you might like
Thank
to talk
you.
About? Well, money is a magnifier, and like adversity, it reveals character. So what you'll see, perhaps, is whoever a person is excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money's going to make them more drunk. If someone's insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone's caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. So it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. Now, money is going to mean all kinds of things for all kinds of clients. There's one thing, no matter what your needs and ideals are, no matter what your regard is of money, there is one common denominator that money has among all people, and that's choice. So no matter what money means to people, there's one common denominator. It means choice. If people have money, they have choices that are available to them that people without money don't have. Now, that assumes they're free to use that choice, but that's something to keep in mind that, you know, that as you work with clients, because this is going to be an issue. Now, I know we've only really introduced some ideas. If there are some other aspects or questions that you have, since we have to stop now, let's pick up at the beginning of next time. Jot them down and let's talk about them, because I think that there are aspects of this that are really crucial for you, for your story, and for your professional coaching story, because this is going to be an issue at the interface of your work with clients. And if there are any things that might be helpful for us to talk about, in addition to what we've done, let's do it. Thank you very much, and I look forward to picking up with you next time. You have, guys have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks very, very much. Bye now. See ya.
Bye-bye.
See you guys.